Blog Talk Radio.
By His grace, we step into the month of March, feeling joy of always having that feeling of peace, and moving into, moving through 2020. I'm Mark Elliott, ready to kind of start another episode of When Black Men Talk. The podcast basically that was kind of going to a male's perspective in conversation based around love, life, and relationships. I'm happy that we always kind of shoot for an honest stuff evaluation, because if you can't be honest with yourself, who are you being honest with? And not afraid to be honest with ourselves. Enjoy the fact that we do that and boldly saying some things that need to be said. Man, looking at some things. Actually, I went back and listened to last week's show, and I was looking at the location where folks might be checking this show out from. And I knew we had an audience in Frankfurt, Germany. And it seems like Belgian Germany has decided to basically tune into us. And I want to thank everyone for listening, if you're in the United States, wherever you are, you know. But when it seems to be foreign countries, segments of foreign populations, for some reason, click in and decide to give us an ear, and it rocks the heart. So I want to thank you folks, wherever you are. But in Germany, man, I really want to thank you, because I'm sure there's other things that you could be paying attention to, giving your ear to, and if you have decided for whatever reason to listen to us, we're thankful and we're appreciative. And tell your friends, tell your family, tell your mama, tell your daddy, tell them all about what we're doing here. I wanted to congratulate someone. You know, we do salute from time to time, and we will do a salute on this show, but I want to congratulate someone that this got past me, and I think it may have gotten past the other two gentlemen on this show, that a few months ago, maybe about a month and a half ago, Dawn Stanley picked up a contract from the South Carolina University of $22 million over a seven-year period. And if you break that down, if I do my math correctly, what is that about? $3 million a year? Maybe a little over $3 million a year. And I say to myself, wow. I remember a little while ago, Becky Hammond left being assistant coach for San Antonio Spurs, and she went to Las Vegas Aces in the WNBA, and she's making $1 million a year. So when you look at that way, you put in proper perspective that Dawn Stanley is making $3 million a year, one of the highest paid black coaches in America. And when she was probably playing college, we watched her dribble the ball playing college, we watched her in the WNBA, I'm not sure if we knew one day, Mr. DeMaurice, we would be saying congratulations to one Dawn Stanley and job well done for what she's done at South Carolina. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, she definitely earned it, man. You know, as a player, as a coach, playing on the USA team, she definitely earned her spot, and especially in women's college basketball, where UConn was the dominant team over the years. And she has done a great job of recruitment, done a great job of building a program there where they're right in the thick of things every year. And so kudos to her, because she definitely earned her scratch, as they say.
Mr. Charles, I was watching a video for yesterday where some of her former players is talking about it, and Asia Wilson is playing in the WNBA, phenomenal player. She's so phenomenal. They built a statue of her at South Carolina University. She went there and graduated, of course, playing now professionally. But she said Dawn Stanley is unapologetically, brutally honest with you. And she said that's something she needed. And it seems like that's something that her players kind of attached themselves to. And I love that part about her, because a lot of times people, they want to sugarcoat things and kind of go around. But when you hear that she's unapologetic, brutally honest, how did that strike you, Mr. Charles? Good morning.
Good morning. Actually, I think it's right on point. And I say that because I think oftentimes some of the coaches that are so-called polished and they come from certain backgrounds or they have experienced a lot of success, they are in it to win games, of course, make a lot of money, and rest on their laurels, which is fine. You can do that. That's the way to go about it. But for Dawn Staley, knowing where she came from, her background, probably, you know, whatever, how she lives her life, there's always going to be some stressors, some intangibles, some things that are always coming for the young ladies that perhaps come from a very difficult situation. And you don't do them any favors by telling them things they want to hear. And that might mean she might lose some players because they think they're all that and they don't want to be dealing with her discipline and go to another program. But when she tells you things that are straightforward that are probably going to come to pass, I think it helps them realize, the ones that want to pay attention, that they need to take their heads out the clouds and come down to reality, because now it's no longer high school. We're having fun jumping around, going to AAU basketball tournaments or whatever, and just having fun and people telling you how great you are. This is a business. And I think that goes a long way from her, simply because of the fact that she knows where they come from and she can relate. There are so many coaches, I think, that go into living rooms and talk to parents and whatnot, and they can't relate. So they sell you a pipe dream. And when the dream explodes and you don't know how to deal with it, you're back at home mad as hell because it didn't work out.
I'm listening to Mr. Charles, and I'm thinking of somewhere down the line, I wouldn't be surprised, in her past, she had a grandmother that gave it to her harshly and gave it to her straight, because I could speak for myself, and you too, I'm going to come back to you and see if you two had this luxury in your life. You know, my grandmother would give it to you just the way it's supposed to be served. If your feelings got hurt, she ain't giving you a tissue. It's just, it was that honesty. What, I'm not apologizing for it, but this is the honesty that's going to serve you well, that's going to help build your character, help strengthen you, help you deal with things that's later to come on in life. And that's what she does with her students. And you think about it, she kind of prepares them, not kind of, she does prepare them to move beyond basketball, move into life. Don't let some of the small tribulations rock your boat, sink your battleship. So I'm thinking at some point, I say grandmother, and I'm not saying it could have been her mother. It might have been her dad. It could have been whatever. But for some reason, I'm thinking it could have been her grandmother, Mr. Jimmy Reese. Your thoughts in responding to somebody might have been in her, you know, her previous early upbringing that allow her to build this within her character and basically impose it to other characters that she comes across.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. I think her family, being from Philly, he will give you a rude awakening on who you are and who you're supposed to be, and not, you know, she has that Philly swagger about her. You know, when you see her, even to this day, she has that swagger about her. And coming from that environment, coming from family, whether it was a grandmother, mother, or dad, or being on the basketball court with some of the guys, earning her, you know, reputation as one of the best basketball players out of that area. You know, there's a lot of things that can groom you. And, you know, you just don't take shorts. I know our grandmother knew the society that we were going to step into. So she didn't want to sugarcoat things. She wanted to lay it out to you, not as it should be, but the way it is. And so many of us, I think, you know, took heed to that, and that made us successful in life. But definitely her environment, her family, was definitely, you could see the influence on what that did to her and how that made her successful and the drive she has in life.
You know, it's interesting, Mr. Charles. I've heard people, grown people, call adults, you know, their relatives or whatever, baby and all that stuff, and they think it's cute. They do. They think it's cute. But I can honestly say, I know for a fact my grandmother ain't never called me a baby, no matter what age I was. And if I think hard enough, I don't think my mama did either. And, you know, that's my baby. Or I never heard all that. And I wonder sometimes how that plays into someone's psychic, in a sense. But giving you the same, you know, coming to the same question to you, Mr. Charles, in a sense where I believe there must have been someone, you know, I'm going to say grandma. I'm going to go out on a limb and say grandma that basically served it up to her this way to help build her into who she turned out to be. Your response, sir?
Yeah, no doubt. I think there was had to be somebody because life is tough. And even as a young person in your situation, you might think you have all the answers. And you might be headstrong. We often are headstrong. I can speak to that firsthand. Being very headstrong and thinking you have all the answers and knowing what you're doing. And then you have, when you realize you have no damn clue what happened. You have no idea what you're, you have no plan, you have no idea. You just know you think you know. You think you're smart, you think you know everything. But a person in your life like that, a grandma, whoever it may be in her life, clearly made a difference. And DeMarie hit it on the head. She's from Philadelphia. I had an auntie that lived in North Philly, bro. I went to North Philly when I was a teenager. Right in the on the block, in the row houses, and it was a tough crowd. And being from Ohio, I got a rude awakening because I had to stay for the whole summer and learn the way. And, you know, my auntie wasn't a soft lady either. You know, she had a pistol. She would shoot you, shot a couple people, but everybody respected her. So the whole point of it is those individuals teach you things like that. And it's really a tough place, especially in those type of areas. So I think with Don Staley, her experience in Philly and her wherever else was in her life taught her there was nothing she couldn't overcome. Because for those that have been through some really tough patches and situations, when you get through out of surviving where you came from and overcame those barriers, the rest of the world is just like, hell, you don't have nothing for me. If you knew my story, if you knew her story probably, you go, damn. So I think she used that as fuel and energy to even help other people. And I think that's what's so key. And we all have our stories. But, yeah, something like that goes a long way. And it'll fuel you for the rest of your life. Because once you make it past the hardest part of your life where you think it to be, the rest of it is, you know, it's just kind of icing on the cake. You can make it through.
Yeah, we're also some filler, yeah. They're. Congratulations to one Dawn Staley, not for the contract. That's a beautiful woman itself, but your accomplishment for being who you are, the woman that you are, and the way that you're affecting other lives. We continue to congratulate you and salute you on that. I want to salute someone else that, this one is long overdue. Mr. Charles, you brought this to the surface a few nights ago. This person here, I don't even know, is a race of people. Have we really given her what she truly deserves? Some of us have looked at her in a different light that wasn't called for. A political scientist, honored with several awards such as the School of Humanities and Sciences Dean's Award of Distinguished Teaching. If you have an idea, I'm not sure who I'm talking about. I'm talking about one Khadiza Rice, former Secretary of State of the United States of America. And when you just take that itself right there, the former Secretary of State of the United States of America, think about she took on that position, how she was awarded or given that position, and what that position speaks to. And a lot of times if we go back, you know, if we go back and look at our political people, our politicians, whatever, we're going to think of Obama first, and we may think of Michelle Obama shortly thereafter. But I will venture to believe and think a lot of times, for some reason, we stop short of thinking of her. Now, I want to kind of focus on that a little bit because honor and salute her at the same time. But I want to kind of focus on why is it, Mr. Charles, and, you know, and you can speak to her greatness too as well, because I don't think we fully understand how powerful and how strong and how dynamic this woman is. But when all that is said and done, as people, I'm wondering why we haven't fully honored her.
To start with that point, I think a lot of people, particularly with our folks, and the way I grew up in a very segregated community, growing up in Dayton, Ohio, most people stayed to themselves. And we were taught a certain way that even when it came to politics, it was mostly people of color, African Americans, that voted for the Democrats, and white people voted for Republicans. Unless you had a lot of money, and then you might sneak over and not tell anybody that you were Republican, you were African American. But with that being said, I think that has been the way for a lot of people of color, particularly African Americans, in their households and their traditions. And then to see a sister like this that goes above and beyond a lot of successful things in life that people can only imagine. And then she takes a stand and chooses to take a position with a political party that is often conceived as evil or foreign to a lot of people of color. That's what we were taught, a lot of us. But for her, it was an opportunity to be in the position, not so much about, she was always about the political party. It was about being a stand-up, a person that could represent and make solid decisions for this country. And I think that's what a lot of people miss. Imagine you had somebody else in there that didn't have a clue. I think the same can be said about the choice of Colin Powell. When you're in that power, you want the right people. It may not be exactly the perfect way they got there, but I think that's how the reason why we as a people often look at her differently, like she's not one of us. But I think a lot of times we are misguided, we are confused because we don't know the whole story. And if you knew that, you would understand. That's why she also was chosen when down at Augusta National, they're having issues with losing the Masters tournament because they didn't have people of color. She's one of the first females inducted into their, as a member. And the way she ran with that is because who she was. So I think a lot of it comes down to confusion on our parts. And now it's time, since the world is opening up a lot, for the first African-American president and the first African-American / woman of color as a vice president, it's time for us to open our minds to why people do what they do. And just because they're associated with the one particular party that we were taught was bad doesn't mean they're not good people.
Man, I couldn't have said that any better, brother. I'm telling you, man, and to basically resonate, opening the minds is key, because I always looked at it, why she didn't get what she fully deserved as far as our honor, our support, and our admiration, is because George Bush, she's linked to George Bush, he picked her. And going on what you said, we always looked at that party, and a good part of us looked at George Bush, that he didn't like black people. Remember when someone said that? I don't even want to say that idiot's name, but he said that when things went down in New Orleans. He came out and said it. And he was basically speaking what a lot of black people thought and felt. So you look at that and you tie that to her, you automatically, for no reason, start to dislike her. Don't feel a certain way about her. Don't look at her honestly, what she represents or who she is and what she's capable of doing. Don't respect the job or the title that she's put into. And I think, you know, in spite of all that, this woman has basically blossomed and continues to blossom and is doing some amazing things, Mr. DeMaurice. I want to bring you and get your response, sir.
Yeah, she's tied into an administration that's not really popular, that made a lot of missteps, but it doesn't represent what she brought to the table. And I think once, you know, you get locked into an administration that, because I always think that George Bush is on his knees every day thanking the emergence of Donald Trump. Because if it wasn't for Donald Trump, we would still be talking about how the Bush administration really kind of fouled things up in this country. I mean, we were on the verge of, going belly up in this country. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. And she was part of that. And so she gets associated with that. And, yeah, a lot of good people who probably worked in that administration who maybe didn't agree with everything that was going on that were doing their part, but you get lumped into that. And sometimes that's unfair, you know. After that, she just really kept doing the work. She kept doing things that that really made her shine as far as college football. I know Charles mentioned that on last week's show, on the sports show we do. And she you know, she really continued to shine and use her talents. And so finally, hopefully, she will be recognized away from that administration, because let's look at it. She's done some things to earn that spot before she got selected for that administration. We should be honoring that and recognizing that, you know, because, you know, you just don't get selected to be in that position in the administration just by, you know, just on a whim. You know, people see talent. People see the connections you made. People see that how you can help them. I think in some respects, she kind of really kind of saved that administration from a lot of different things that could have gone even worse. So, and had the ear of the president and say, okay, we need to do this now. We need to do this now to really kind of cover for things that you know, and we've had that experience with black women all our lives. If there's a big old mess up, they know how to fix it. They know how to kind of put it on the right track. So we really need to really kind of separate her from that, because that's over, and really, you know, acknowledge her for the accomplishments even before the administration she worked for and after, all the stuff that she's doing. And she does it quietly. She doesn't beat her chest. She doesn't, you know, go around bragging, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. She doesn't even fight with people. If you have an opinion of her, that's your opinion. She just keeps on moving. So we have to acknowledge the strength and the integrity that she upholds, regardless of all the things that she's been around and the administration she's been a part of. She continues to just strive, and you just got to give a salute to that.
I like you saying, oh, sisters put it back on track, but a lot of times that's what happens, man. We mess it up as men, and once we kind of mess things up, we want to walk away from it. And they have in many cases come in where we walked away from, where we damaged, what we left ruined, finds a way to restore and bring back the glory. And we should never forget that as men. I want to move a little bit and talk about the heart. Because we don't, you know, in the past few shows, I was talking how the heart sends out rays 3 feet past the body. And I don't think sometimes we pay enough attention to what our heart is doing. We wake up on a daily basis and we go about our business. We give thanks. We live a full day. We try to live a full life to the best of our ability. And we don't think about the organs that allows us to do such. And two, there's a problem with them. You know, if there's a problem, then you start to pay attention and we start to realize, okay, the importance of that particular organ. But the heart that sends blood to our arteries is beyond amazing. You know, beyond amazing. And the human heart is roughly the size of a large fist. It weighs about 10, maybe 12 pounds in weight. But it's one of God's greatest development. Something to ponder in our minds, you know, in the sense that I was doing a little research and I realized that it's probably nothing new, but our mind affects our heart in more ways than we probably understand and give weight to. And the heart needs good emotional health to maintain good cardiovascular health. And what's interesting about saying that is a lot of times, you know, we eat foods or we think, okay, we're exercising cardio for our heart, which is great. Don't get me wrong. But if you're not maintaining emotional health, good emotional health, you're damaging your heart. They work in connection with each other very tightly. So I wonder sometimes, Mr. Charles, because here's a word that's thrown around, it's been thrown around for years. To me, this word meant worriation when I came up. And to me, worriations were more of the black way or black way to stress the word stress. And stress to me kind of became the popular word that we use to basically show something that's burning in our minds, something we're spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, feeling overwhelmed about, kind of pulling us down, something that we probably couldn't understand or try to change, things that happen in life, tribulations, trials. You know, we kind of put it all together and we rolled over that one big ball and we called it stress. But I wonder, you know, have we given credence to how stress basically tears down one of God's greatest development, the heart?
I don't think so. And I'll say this about, I won't put this as far as a race of color on this, but I think so many times people are taught, you need to be, particularly for men, we need to be tough. We need to be strong. And you just need to keep working and just forget about things. But in our own quiet moments, we all probably so-called stress or we worry about things, and that gets in your head and your psyche, and it can go to your heart. And I think I used to watch different things or pay attention. The Native Americans perhaps had it best, man. You know, they always took time to learn how to control their breathing and control your pulse. Because you're really angry about something, blood vessels can be affected, all kinds of stuff can be affected. You can make yourself literally sick. But if you took time just to go, whatever it is, I can handle it, and control your body functions. What I mean by that, taking deep breaths, closing your eyes, take a few moments to get your numbers back on point. So if you take time to control your breathing, remove all that negativity out of your mind, it goes a long way, because we're always on the, let's just say this, we're always usually under the gun. There's pressure. You got to do something by a certain time. You got deadlines, getting calls from home, whatever family may be, and you're putting all this, trying to compartmentalize all this together and trying to balance it all in the same moment. So with that, all that being said, I think it's very important. I think it's a way of taking care of yourself, realizing what you think in your mind can affect your physical. And if you really understand that, you understand how important it is daily to take time out for yourself just to get yourself back on track.
Yes, sir. That's it right there, man, because it's doing damage, and it's sad to think the damage that's being done is being done quietly. You may never feel it. So if you're not feeling it, you're going about your normal way of doing things. And believe it or not, a lot of us that are attracted to the drama and feel we must need that and have that, those, all that up and down emotional roller coaster stuff, because it becomes a way of comfortability for you. When it's not there, you don't feel normal. But with all that's going on, you're not thinking or giving thought to what you could be doing to your heart. With that respect, Mr. DeMaurice, I want to get your response, sir.
Yeah, I don't really think that people understand how stress can really affect your overall health. And it really kind of hit me years ago. I was going to grad school. I was working full-time. I was in a marriage I didn't want to be in. And there was all kind of stress in my life, deadlines, all other stuff. And I remember going to a doctor's visit with my doctor at that time. And he was like, listen, man, and he was a brother, you know, real cool brother. He was like, listen, man, he's like, you got to let something go. He said, whatever is stressing you out the most in your life at this particular point, he said, you got to let it go, because if you don't, you're getting ready to run up into some health issues that, you know, you got too much on your plate, or you being stressed out. He said, now, I knew you before, you know, you know, you got married and all this other stuff. He said, and if there's some issues there, you got to figure out a way to, you know, resolve those issues and move on in order to have good health. And when he said that, a light bulb came on. It was like a go light came on, like, okay, it's time to let the marriage go. I said, because I can handle work. Work's not stressful to me. School is not stressful to me. This is the stuff that is the source of my stress. So I'm like, you know, I looked at him. I said, I got it, and I'm gone. And he started laughing. he started laughing. And so, because I know you, you know, you're in your cardiovascular health and all that other stuff. I know you work out. I know, you know, you're a pretty athletic guy. You know, you stay active. He said, but something is different. He said, I'm not trying to pinpoint what it is, but whatever that thing is, you need to let it go or you're going to run into some health problems. And, you know, there's some statistics where, you know, I'm not saying African-American men, but men in general, you know, when you're under a lot of stress, you know, we don't live as long as women. And so, man, I listen to music to try to get rid of stress. I don't, if it's a stressful or drama situation, I don't want to be a part of it. If it's a potential of it, I don't want to be a part of it. People always marvel at, I'm 55 years old, and there are people who are 55 years old who look like they're 85 years old. And they look at me and like, you're 35, aren't you? No, I'm about 55. Like, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me. I was doing a presentation for a group out of East St. Louis who, you know, thinking about coming to our university and talking to the young people. And there was a young lady in the group. I was like, how old are you? So I get that question all the time. I said, I'm 55. Oh, you can't be. You just can't be 55. And they were asking me, what did I do to try to be youthful? And I said, I stay away from stress. I stay away from drama. I can't deal with it. I don't want to deal with it. So, you know, I don't think people really realize that for your overall health, you got to let the stress go. I'm not saying that there are not going to be stressful situations in your life, and you can deal with that. You're equipped to deal with that. But it's every day, I mean, just pounding on you, it's going to wear out your heart. It's going to throw up your blood pressure. You know, you're gonna start eating crazy. You know, you're not going to take time to kind of, you know, deal with your body. Take walks, exercise, try to get relief from that stress. And we as a people, I don't think, you know, we're dealing with so many things in society. We don't really take time to really say, you know what, I need a quiet place where I can just listen to some music, or a quiet place where I can meditate for a while, or a part of my life where I just do some physical activity just to burn off that stress. It's just not burning off calories and fat. It's burning off stress. So I think as a people, we really need to take heed to that, because I know you hear about people who are stress eaters. When you get stressed, you tend to eat certain things that you ain't supposed to be eating because you're trying to comfort your body and your soul. And sometimes that's not always, and some people get stuck in that mode where they're eating a lot of stuff that's not good for your body and your soul. Now you're stressing your body out to try to digest all this stuff, you know, to keep the body functioning wisely, folks.
Yeah, stress would definitely age you, man, without a doubt. If you allow yourself to ride that roller coaster of it, and you look in the mirror, and others will see it as well, and you see some markings, and you try to kind of paint it as being age, but it's not. Age-related, it's not. It's all that baggage you've been carrying that you chose not to drop off, all the stuff that you chose as you thought you know, had a handle on that you really didn't. And you take on, sometimes we take on other people's stress. Someone could come to you and they're worried about our stress. Now, I'm going to forget stress for the rest of this conversation. I'm going to say worry. I'm going old school. They could be worried about something and they bring it to you. Now you're worried about what they're worrying about. And you may continue to worry about it when they done figured it out and moved on. You still worried. And I remember I used to say that to my sister years ago. My older sister from my father through marriage, she would always bring, if he had problems with her husband, she would bring it to our mother. And then, you know, when she's gotten over it, mom's still mad at him. You ain't mad at him no more, but mommy's still mad at him. And I said to her, you can't bring every time your feelings are hurt to mommy. What are you talking about? I said, because simple point. You know, you're mad for about 10, 15 minutes. Mom mad at him for a couple of days. You don't realize what that might be doing to her. That make no sense. It don't make no sense to you because you want to come over like a little baby and complain. But what's going on with you? Work it out with him. She don't need to every time he hurts your feelings. Don't come running to her. So realistically, especially as parents sometimes, you know, you hurt when you feel your kids are hurting. You know, they're in situations that they may not should be in. You take that on because there's not much you can do. And a lot of times at the center of our stress, there it is again, the center of our worryation, is because we're thinking about a situation we can't control. And the more you think about and realize you can't control, do nothing about it, the more you ramping up your worryation. But when you give it to God and let him handle it, it relieves you of all of that. Truly gives it to him. Don't say you give it to him. Give it to him earnestly and walk away from it. You know, that allows you not to have your heart banger, 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 your mind banging, 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 because it's going to work out one way or another anyway. And when you can't do anything about it, why are you worrying about it? Again, when you can't do nothing about it, if you've done the best you could, why are you worrying about it? But you brought up, you know, love in a sense. I think I heard you say this, Mr. Reese, and it's kind of interesting because I came across this study, man. This to me was fascinating. And it kind of hinged on the heart, but anxiety and love. And interesting thing about anxiety, it leads to rapid heartbeat. And love leads to a soothing heart. Now, this study was done back in 1976. I was in high school. I think I was in junior high. I was a freshman in junior high school in 1976. And it was done in Israel. They took 10,000 married men, and they asked every single one of them, do your wife show you love? Simple. You would think they all would, hell yeah. Yeah, yes, 10,000 married men, and ask, do your wife show you love? And the ones with high level of anxiety, high level, not a, you know, not a little level, 93% of them said no. Those men went on to develop Enigma-related chest pains within 5 years later from 1976. Now, Mr. Reese, you talked about earlier why men tend to die, married men sometimes tend to die, or men tend to die younger than women. And it's been said years. This is nothing new. We grew up knowing and hearing that, that their lifespans tend to outlive ours. I think this study here kind of shows it. Because if you're living with someone day in and day out, and that situation is causing you an anxiety that's going on every day and it's festering, look what it's doing to your heart. You ever seen people have heart attacks, or guys have heart attacks? And you say, damn, I thought he was healthy. He wasn't, you know, he was doing XYZ. And you go, wait a minute. Or maybe you should have went, wait a minute. Yeah, he was healthy from appearance part of you. But when you dig into the mental psychic, what he might have been dealing with, anxiety, other stuff of worryation, trying to carry on, do manipulate this, all this on his shoulders led to bang in his heart. Again, the mind and the heart has a great connection. And what is interesting is that when one hurts, it can hurt the other one. And I think as we wake up and walk around daily, Mr. Charles, you made some good points about doing some things and realizing, opening up and realizing, yes, you don't want to, you know, be cognizant of the heart. Yeah, we need to, especially as men. Because men, we, you know, we want to believe we're hard, we're tough, we're this and that. You ain't tough as nothing when you're buried in your casket, bro. You're not. That's not tough. And you want to kind of find a way to relieve that. If it means speaking to someone, finding things to do, yes. I mean, that's more tough to do. I'll call you tough when you do that. But thinking that I can carry this, I'm good with this, when you're not, when it's silently killing you inside, ain't nothing tough about that. So your reaction to the study, Mr. Charles, 10,000 married men. You know, you never been married, bro, so you couldn't have been in this. This type, you could never probably have been in something like a study such as this. But when you hear about this study, Mr. Charles, what's your reaction, brother?
Woo! Glad I missed that one. No, just funny. Anyway. I'm just joking. Marriage is beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. But speaking on the from the outside looking in, I concur. I can see that because think about that. You got hit on some great points. You are a married man. You come home. You work real hard. You're doing everything you can to try to make sure your household works, whatever, however, from a financial standpoint. And then also whatever you're bringing in to try to be a leader or whatever situation may be at home to try to make this a good place for everyone, right? A very great place as a home. And you're doing all this work, you're putting all this work in, and you're busting your butt, you're dealing with stress at the job, somebody, whatever it is. And then you come home to the people that are supposed to be what you're doing it for, right? And your wife never really shows you love. And it's like, well, damn, what am I doing this for? Why am I in this situation? And it goes, it wears on you. You go, well, I still got to take care of my kids. I still have to do what I need to do. But if you're able to take a step back and look at it logically, you go, this don't make no damn sense. How many women would love to be in the position that you're in and you're taking it for granted or you just don't give a damn? And as a man, even though we're taught to be tough guys and leaders, after a while you go, your mind, your body is like, and then it's that other thing too where you don't feel the love, but somebody always asking for something, which means you got to go out and get more money. It's always give me. And you can't say, I'm not doing that, because that's what you feel obligated to do because you signed up for it, correct? So I see how that can work, and I can see why those men were feeling the way that they were. Because at the end of the day, get off this point very quickly, no matter how tough we are, how strong we are as men, how badass we are, how strong-willed we are, we still need to be loved, man. We still want to be appreciated. We still want to be built up. And we hope that our queens, our women, can assist in that to make us feel that we're on the right track. I mean, we have our spirituality too, which is key, but you still need your queen, man. And if the queen don't love you, damn, what you doing it for? You might as well be by yourself. Anyway, but I'm just saying, so I'll leave that right there for you, gentlemen.
Man, that's bullseye right there, my brother, because, you know, I was thinking in terms of even coming out with a question, because to me, this study shows a lot. Somewhere in this study, it shows the man's need to be loved. It's not necessarily a desire, you know, because you could desire and never get it. But the man's earnest and fundamental need to be loved. You know, with that being said, Mr. DeMaurice, you know, what are your thoughts of the study and speak to the man's desire to a need to be loved, not desire, need. I mean, what we basically, we have found ways to go without it and be good, semi-good, but at the end of the day, there is a need for a man to be loved. And Mr. Charles kind of laid it out real good. Now, you're working, you're doing X, Y, Z, you're doing all that stuff, and you don't expect the folks outside of your home. It was always kind of said, a man's home is his castle. So when a man come home to his castle, and he's not getting love there, he ain't, you know, love is not there. And I mean, where are you going to get it? At the supermarket? Give me 3 pounds of love, 2 pounds of the, here you go, Mr. DeRosa. I'm sorry if I got off topic a little bit, but your thoughts on the study, and again, the basic humanistic need of a man to be loved. And I'll be honest, I think that's one of the things that we have totally treated undervalued. And I think we spoke numerous times in the show, and I spoke recently to how men is looked upon as being a wallet. And I think when people hear me say, oh, it's not, wallet represents more than just holding money, but it's wallet basically do things like to serve. And I think men are looked upon to serve, do this, do that, do whatever. And forget the fact that we're still human and we need love as energy. Your takeaway, Mr. DeMaurice.
Yeah, I was on a I was watching some fights last night, and I was texting Mr. Charles back and forth in certain fights. And he remembers this. I texted one time and said, "Why is the trainer drinking the fighter's water?" And he said, he responded back, "I guess he's thirsty." So I'm gonna take that situation there. It's like, as men, you're in a fight every day. You're going out there. How many rounds you're gonna fight? All that. You got an opponent in front of you fighting. When you come back to your corner, you're supposed to be recharged. You're supposed to get your water. You're supposed to get some advice. You get some support. You get you know some other perspectives, things of that sort, to help you, you know, go out there and win out there. And when you got people in your corner, or your main person in your corner, they icing themselves down, they're drinking the water, they sitting on the stool you're supposed to be sitting on, and you don't get that recharge. Love recharges men. Love recharges us as men. And if you're not going to recharge us with love, then you're going to start wondering, when you go in there and getting beat down by life, what is this all for? What is it? And I've been there. You know, I've been there in a marriage where it's like, you know, what am I out here doing all this for? Where when I get home, I'm not getting the stuff I need to continue to recharge and get out here and do what I need to do. And then you start to kind of do it on your own, because you know you're not going to get it at home. You kind of find other ways to recharge. Now, some guys may recharge with getting a side piece. Some guys may recharge by, you know, hanging out and doing things with the boys, all this other stuff. Or if you find another vice that you can get into to help you recharge, or to substitute what you're supposed to be getting at home, strip clubs, whatever. But you're going to find a way to recharge, because you need to be recharged to get the energy to go out there and do what you got to do. And, you know, I know women, it's hard on women in life, but it's really hard to be a man in society when you're expected to do something. And sometimes you fall short of the expectations. And so you get the pressure and you get the stress and all that stuff that you're not a real man if you don't do X, Y, and Z. And if, especially if you're hearing that in society and you're coming home hearing the same thing, then, you know, you're put in a pretty tough situation as a man. That stuff kind of sinks into your head and your thoughts. And so that makes some of us make decisions, some maybe good decisions or oftentimes poor decisions. So when you said that, I thought about that text I sent about, why is the trainer drinking the water? You know, you could have drunk the water while they were fighting. when you're sitting in the corner while the fighter's fighting. But to see the fighter, see you drink water while they're out there fighting, to me, that was bad optics. That was real bad optics. Like, this is supposed to be for me. You're supposed to be here for me, but you are taking advantage that, you know, of me in this particular situation. So it's like being in a 12-15 round fight. You know, give me something that is worth fighting for, and I'll go out there and I'll slay the dragon. But if I'm coming back and you're beating on me too, whether it's mentally or physically, then what the hell am I doing? Why am I putting myself out to do this stuff? And a lot of men find themselves in that situation. So I'm not surprised about this study. It's almost as if after the wedding, after all the work that's put in the wedding, women just say, okay, it's all over. I won, and that's it. And I'll just, enjoy the spoils of my victory at this particular point. Because you do become a wallet. You become a resource that they feel like it's unlimited resources they can tap into and get everything they want, and you get nothing. Saying this, and I'll keep saying this until somebody proves me wrong, marriage is a business transaction. And, Joe Pesci said this best in one of the movies with Donald Glover and all the, you get really kind of screwed in the drive-thru. As a man in marriage, you get screwed. It is not a business transaction that is advantageous to men. It's not. You get screwed at the drive-thru when you're married. And somebody prove me wrong. Get a guess, whatever. send emails, whatever. Prove me wrong. It's a business transaction that men usually lose out to, because the way society is set up, And so am I against marriage? No, if you find the right person. But I always tell men, you know, you better make sure you're sure, because if things go funky, you're going to lose out. You're going to get what my boy calls the fuck sandwich.
The what sandwich?
The fuck sandwich.
Yeah, you probably get it with no bread, but wow, you know, something to take notice too. You know, during stress and negative emotions, the heart rhythm patterns becomes erratic, and it can hinder clear thinking and reasoning. So we, with all this being said, we really must start to pay attention to the connection of the mind and the heart. And don't think because something's bouncing around in your head and it's kind of stressing your head or worrying your head, stretching your head, that your heart's not being affected, because they connect with each other. And what's going on up top is definitely going on in your chest, probably even greater. And over a period of time, what's going on in your chest, at some point, it's going to come to pay and visit you. It's When Black Men Talk. Mr. DeMaurice, Mark Elliott, Mr. Charles, take a little break. We'll come back.
Don't you crack a sister. Don't you crack a sister. Don't you crack a baby. Don't you crack a sister.
Ago, I said to myself, if I ever get married again, it would be for money. Be damned if it's going to be for love. It's going to be for cold cash money. I'll come to you first, Mr. DeMaurice, because you know, I know if I thought this, knowing you the way I know you, been knowing you for years, you may have thought the same thing. Have you not?
Yeah, I did think about it, and I had the opportunity to date some women who were wealthy, a couple of millionaires, and what I started to notice, and I'm not saying that this was all women, there were like three or four of them I did date that were very wealthy, and what I discovered in all of them is that it came a point in time in the relationship when they really couldn't be there for you on an intimacy level or on a connection level emotionally, then they try to manipulate you with the money or make you obligated with the money. And I'm always one like, you know, don't give me gifts just to be just giving me gifts, because I feel like I got to match that, or I got to, you know, that I got to do something for it. No, you're doing something for it. Don't get me wrong. Ain't nothing free. But it was almost like they were trying to buy your love. And it's like, no, that's not what love is all about, you know. So I can pay for my own clothes. I can do for myself. I don't need you for that. I need you for the emotional and the intimacy and the love. And it seemed like the money to them was a substitute for that. And then it sets up for them to be kind of controlling in the relationship. And I just didn't dig that, you know, because I'm going to be the man. Regardless of how much money you make, I'm going to be the man. And so if you feel like you're going to be the man, then I ain't dating a man. I ain't going to be with a man, so I need to go find me a woman. So not to say that, you know, there's a woman out there who has money who can, who is feminine, who is not an alpha female. out there. I'm not saying that, but the ones that I met, that kind of emerges in time over the relationship because things that they lack, and they think money can substitute it, and it doesn't. It doesn't. You know, and I find myself walking away or saying, you know what, this may not work, and maybe we should just be friends at that particular point. But I've thought about it, not lately. I ain't been thinking about getting married lately, but I've thought about it in the past, you know, like, oh, man, next time I'm going to do this, that, the other. And I'm like, you know, I had to snap out of it. Like, what do you think about? You know, you ain't getting married no more. So what are you thinking about? So, but yeah, in my experience, it was that they try to substitute the money for things that they're lacking, whether it's their personality, whether it's insecurity, things of that sort, and try to buy you and not really try to fortify the relationship.
Yeah, money provides certain things that can give off a feeling, but money cannot sustain and really fortify the relationship, therefore a marriage. And I think for myself, when I was saying those things, probably shortly after divorce, it was thinking that certain areas would have been better if money was more available. And not necessarily, that's not necessarily correct. It was a short-lived thought process, but money just doesn't basically smooth out any foundations or any rough edges. You know, for the moment, you know, it's cool, but it doesn't. So, Mr. Charles, you know, same question for you. In terms of you maybe, you know, have been at that step at some time thinking, the person I marry, she must do this, blah, 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 blah. A lot of times we think only women think like that, but men have those thoughts as well. You know, we want to mate or a wife that's doing XYZ. So have those been thoughts that have popped in your head at one time or another, sir?
All the time. No, just anyway. But I mean, yeah, because I mean, it would be nice. Men, you know, they try to act like, oh, me, I got my own stuff, but it would be nice for a minute you think about to be okay financially, to be taken care of a little bit. You know, somebody appreciates you from that standpoint with money. But then again, as you said, both of you mentioned the reality of it sets in, and I know how I am, that wouldn't last long. I enjoy the time. We take elaborate trips and enjoy nice things, and then it would come down to a point where I would go, said, well, I did this and I did that and I'm giving you everything you need and this is how we do it. And that controlling aspect will be an issue because I know myself. And I'm like, well, hell, if I can live off $100 a week, you think I need your money? You just go back to the point of where you're at in your life and what's important. And as you mentioned before, that the few things that they're lacking, perhaps as a person, they use their money to try to make up for it. It's kind of like what parents that are well-off, sometimes that are wealthy, do for their kids. They try to show their kids they love them by giving them great gifts, by buying them something. But the one thing that you can never buy and you can't put a price on is time and love. That's what everybody needs, particularly mates and men and whatnot, too. We all need time and love. And you can't put a price on that. But, yeah, I have thought about it, but I already know it wouldn't last. Because I'd be like, all you got is your money. What else? What else? And that would not turn out well. So we move on.
Yeah. I was watching this video the other day, and this gentleman was talking to this young lady. And he was kind of clowning her in a sense, and I didn't like this. Because I thought what she was saying was honest and sincere. And she said that she date men, and, you know, he said, okay, what type of man? She said, you know, she said, I just want a guy just kind of basically work. She said, I'm not saying. She said, well, how much? She said, no. She said, most of the guys I date don't make more than $40,000. He's like, $40,000? She said, yeah. She said, I'm not looking at a man for his money. I'm looking at a man for who he is. He said, well, you know, she said, bro, I don't care. He could work at McDonald's. She said, if he starts still working at McDonald's and has the desire to own the McDonald's, she says to me, that's the type of guy I like. But he's working. I'm like, this brother wouldn't keep. Now, himself, he was a lawyer. He wasn't. He didn't get it. So he's thinking, no, you went to school, well, and that's good, bro. You've been set up. But what she's saying is that she's looking at a man for, even if he's not making that, he has desire to do better, and he sees she's doing it. That's enough for her. And for some reason, this dumbass couldn't understand that. And I'm like, that's a sister right there. And she says, hard for me to even find that. She said, most men I find like that, she said, they don't work long. She said, they might have the good intentions, but she said, they work for a little while and they stop working. I felt sorry for her because I think I said to you recently, Mr. Demers, there's not a great pool of men out there for women. And this sister just wants a brother that's just going to be a brother. What the standard definition of what a brother should be, that's all she's asking for. And she can't even find it. So to make fun of her, because her expectations of what he should make may not seem elaborate, what are you doing? You penalize her, for expectations are high. And then if she's just said, I don't have those expectations, then you want to call her. As men, we got to be careful sometimes, seriously. But with that being said, I'm going to come back to you, Mr. Charles, because I'm wondering, I know for me, when I've, dated over the years, whatever, I was never impressed or never looking to see what you made. Oh, that was not a starting point for me from the gate to understand. I'm looking at you, who you are. Why am I going to invest some time and energy into you, if anything? But I wasn't necessarily paying attention because I always came my own. So I'm not looking at what you're making in a sense. And I'm wondering, has there been a time when men look at me, yourself, other men? I know other men. We ain't going to talk about them because they're dumb. They know they have. But have you looked at a woman based on, what she makes or her earning potential to be the starting point to get to know her?
Not really. No, because I know that there's more to it than that. And granted, there are a lot. You do think about, if I was with her, what does she bring to the table financially? I mean, that's normal because you're going to be together as a family or whatever. What do I have to do? How much do I have to make up for? What's the potential there? But I think overall it's about the person and who that person is and really getting to understand them as a person. But I think that's the key. So my thing was always been, too, not always about the money. But the one thing I will say, and maybe even we say this all the time, you can't say nobody, they got to understand it. I agree with that 100%. But I do think that all I would do is just want that person to be the best. Be the best of themselves, right? Whoever that person is, be the best of yourself. So whatever your potential is or how far you can go or whatever you want to do, what your aspirations are, be the best you. Because your best you is going to help our relationship. And I think that's all I would ask. I think there's so many times that you're in a relationship, though, that people just stay stuck where they are. They don't try to advance or do anything. And then you don't have to match me or be like me, but be the best you. And we all have dreams normally or something that we want to do or pursue. Be the best you, and we'll figure it out.
Same question for you, Mr. DeMaurice. As you approached intros of meeting someone, whatever, what was the thought process about how much they make, their earning potential, or what they are actually earning?
That didn't come into the equation until, if you decided to be together. Because at the moment of, being introduced to a person, you're trying to get a vibe or get an energy or trying to get to know that person on a level where you're kind of gauging whether or not you want to be with this person or if this person is worthwhile and getting to know and things of that sort. I think the other way around, women kind of look at, what you're wearing, the shoes you're wearing, all this other stuff, to see and gauge, how much you make or your earning potential, things of that sort, what kind of car you drive, all this other stuff. Men are totally different. We're looking at the physical. We're looking at, are we compatible? Are we, is it somebody I like to be with or somebody that can complete a complete sentence without, sounding, like an idiot? So we're looking for different things to try to, grow the relationship. And then, as Mr. Charles said, when you do find out the financial stuff, we're like, okay, how can we work this out? How can we make this happen? you know, without me being used or manipulated to, you know, to be the sugar daddy and all that other stuff. So, no, it's not something that comes in the equation in the initial part of the engagement of being introduced to somebody or, you know, introducing yourself to somebody. It's basically to get to know them as a person to see if this is even worthwhile in pursuing.
You know, real quick, we're going to flip to our questions. Before I come to your first question, Mr. Charles, I want to say something else that I came across. I was watching, and this had me just, I was like, it's sad. It's a 21-year-old girl, 21-year-old lady, is talking to her older sister. And the 21-year-old said she's going to college for a master's at this point. And she says she's looking for someone pay her rent, $13.50 a month. And for he does that, I'll give him great conversation. She said, you're not going to have sex. No, I'm not going to have sex with him. I just want to, you know, be able to, I'll provide him good conversation, yada, yada, yada. And the lady said, what man you think, she said, what age you think you look? She said, well, anyone from 25 to 35. she said, you know, and she was just asking a question to probe to try to show how stupid you are. But it's sad to think that a young lady that's 21 years old, you've been in your college together, that you want someone to come in your life just to basically keep a roof over your head, and you assume the words that come out of your mouth, that equates to them doing that? I'm not even saying if you're having sex with them, but it amazes me where we think, you know, and I'm going to say more women do it than men, that something about you is so quenchable to where we should just come into your world and offer to take your stuff. She said, you know, take me shopping and do those things. For what? What about you is so spectacular? And, yeah, she's 21, but you can make her 31. You can make her 41. You can make her 51. You can make her 60. Because a lot of them think that way. And I'm like, what is so astounding about you, even if you put sex in it? And I know some guys out there are doing it. But I'm sorry. I worked too hard for mine. So I'm just trying to, you know, I'm not even putting that as a question. I just want to start as a thought. That you think that there's something about you that you possess where I should keep a roof over your head monthly. And for the guys that do it, you know, what, you know, I think you're dumb. I really do. I think you're dumb. I honestly do. I mean, I don't care if I was a trillionaire. I wouldn't be keeping a woman. It is what it is. It just is what it is. I wouldn't. That's just not my makeup. And many men do. I work with cats that are broke, work all the time, broke, because these are the dumbass things they're doing and don't understand it. And I'll leave that there, but I find that to be utterly amazing. And she's, and don't get me wrong, she's wrong. But the man that's doing that, if she finds a man that he's just as dumb as wrong as she is, because he's older. Your first question, Mr. Charles.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to send a lot of this. I had a couple of questions, but I think this is going to come off of makes it easier. What is your feeling, or how do you think this is becoming the norm? I saw where Sage Steele works for ESPN, had some, you did something where she let her political views be known, and then she was kind of reprimanded by the company. But I've seen that. I've seen other situations where individuals have been reprimanded or feel like they've been done wrong by their company. Then they sue the company that they work for, their employer, and then go back to work. Do you think that's the new norm, or is this just a few occasions? But I'm seeing a lot more of that.
I haven't seen that happen when they get back to work, bro. And speaking of her in general, she has, in my opinion, she has no platform to work on. I mean, to work with. I think sometimes if that has happened in the past, someone in the company, lawyers to me have influence. They may know someone in the company. They may do this, and they rub things, and they rub things over. But from a legal point of view, she's suing for the freedom of speech. And that's where she's biracial. Let's just say that. Let me say that from the start. And that's where a lot of white people and biracial people get it wrong, because the world has provided you a sense of safe haven. You think, I'm better. You walk around, you step, and you think, you can walk, and the grass is always green when you place your foot. But the company she works for said, wait a minute, you've done something to bring harm to us, so we no longer can keep you aboard. It's fine you feel that way, but your freedom of that you think that you have, your speech, and this was written into the Constitution, where you provide a service, if you heard us from providing you a service, we no longer have to tolerate you. And I would bet on fact that's in a contract that she signed. I work for a corporation. I never signed nothing. But if I was to go out here and basically do some things that bring harm back to them, what do you think they're going to do with me? I know cats that basically, where I work at, have basically got DWIs. Someone went to jail for it. And the union fought hard to make sure the company didn't know. They've done a few months behind bars. And the union covered it up because they knew if the company got wind of it, what would happen or could happen. Now, the company might have looked the other way and said, no, we ain't going to deal with it. But at most part, it will lead to termination. So to me, Sage Steele is still walking around thinking that she's in white land, that she's owed something, and she thinks this lawsuit is going to bring her back. I'm willing to bet you won't see her on that network again. You won't. What's happened in her case is she can't find a job nowhere else. And for the first time in her life, probably her given life, she's faced adversity. And it's got to be somebody else's fault. It can't be what she's done. I'm half white. Well, what did I do wrong? I'm half white. Don't they know I'm half white? The first time that she's knocked on the door probably, and they said, no. Because usually when you're white, half white, I'll just say white, you walk out of one job and the next job is just waiting for you, land on a good mattress. Bang! You just waiting. Oh, I could be fired, and guess what? I got a job tomorrow. But it's been a year, maybe a year and a half. She has no job, bro. And that's where she is, and she's not coming back. So I'm not saying there has been other cases, but she has no leg to stand on. When you decide to open your dumb mouth and talk about the President of the United States and say things about him that's just whatever it may be, and if she comes back to that network, you better bring back Jeneil Hill and bring her back with some cash, bro. Bring her back. Keep an eye on that. Your response, Mr. DeMaurice.
Yeah, I mean, with every company, there are policies with that company, and they're pretty much straightforward. And I think some people, when they get hired, they really don't read that, or they don't pay attention to that in orientation. And I think you're right. When you do something that hurts the company, they have a right to sever ties. And so she's never been one of my favorite anyway. I don't think she really has a case with this, because her job is to read the teleprompter and keep it pushing. That's your job at ESPN. Unless you're one of their stars or stars, your job is to read the teleprompter and keep it pushing. Keep it pushing and do the Sports Center and all that other stuff. And she decided she didn't want to do that. And I think you're right about Jemele Hill. She had some views too. She didn't go the route about suing and all that other stuff. They decided to sever their ties. And she's doing other things. I haven't heard her being hired for anything, but I think she's on Spotify doing her own podcast, things of that sort. I've seen her on shows and different documentaries and things of that sort where people go to her. But I think Sage is disillusioned by a lot of things, and I think she's getting a big reality check now. And I don't think, and we talk about this all the time on a sports show, I don't think you can sue the company and continue to work there. I think they're going to make it very hard if she gets her job back, if she sues the company, very hard for her to work there. And I think there is a, she has a, I mean, she kind of dug her own hole with this and some of the things that she said in the past and trying to be outspoken and being on the wrong side of things. So I don't think anybody else wants to touch it. And I think she's getting a rude awakening. And so usually sometimes there's some lawyer who can convince somebody, yeah, we can sue the company because they infringed on your free speech. Well, you are paid by that company. You have to toe that company line. They have an image they're trying to protect. And they tell you in those production meetings, we're staying away from this. And we're going, this is our company line on this. If you go outside of that, then they have ways of getting you in line, suspending you, or getting rid of you. And I think she finds herself in that position. And I think you're right. I don't know if she's going to find another job somewhere else because, to me, she just wasn't really impressive in her role at ESPN anyway. And she kind of really turned people off in the wrong ways. And it's just going to be interesting to see how this kind of plays out.
Yeah, I'll be highly surprised, man. I'd be highly surprised that she finds a way back there. And it's a last-ditch effort. It really is, in my opinion. And again, like you said, she's delusional. She thinks life, because of, you know, who she is, she thinks she's entitled to. And she's probably, she's been, in my opinion, properly raised to believe that that's what she's owed. You may not be owed it, but I am. And guess what? You're waking up to realize life is totally different. Your response, Mr. Charles?
Yeah, I just wanted to point it out that she's still working, bro.
Yeah.
She's still working.
Yeah.
She's under contract with ESPN. So her contract,
she's on the air
very soon, but she's still, yeah. She's still on the air, and she did a recent master telecast, and she's still anchoring the Sports Center. I think a lot of times, as you said, certain individuals think that they're above certain things. They can do what they want to. But I think ESPN is going to look at this. They're supposed to answer the complaint in a couple weeks. And as you said, you can almost guarantee she will not be asked back. She will not be re-signing a new contract. And I'm not sure she'll be going anywhere else because we said it for a long time on this show. How in the hell do you think, even if you're right, do you think you can sue your employer and go back to work? And they'll not try to get you. I mean, you just think about that from that standpoint. And it is, it's crazy. So I hope she has a nice nest egg for herself because whatever she's going through or whatever she's doing, it's just crazy. I guess my main thing with this is, her going on this podcast and saying certain things, you almost had to know they was coming for you. You set yourself up, but you still had to go out there knowing what you're saying, knowing what you're doing is going to catch some people's attention, and then you're out in the public eye. So I don't know. It just almost, I've seen a few other things where things just happened, but I'm just kind of curious how you get away with that.
But her still working says to me that she's trying to set up herself to get the next contract, which she's not going to get, which they probably told her they're not going to give her the next contract. It reminds me a little bit of Michelle Tafoya. I think that's her last name, that was on NBC doing the sidelines on NBC, Sunday Night Football. And she went on The View, and she said some things about Colin Kaepernick. And NBC, they suspended her for a little while, but they didn't fire her. And what they did is allow her to basically work out the remainder of her contract and said adios. And at that point, and this is, it's, you know, hearing that, it's even smarter for her employer. Because right now, your suit has no basis. Because they, even it had none to start, but if they kept you employed, they didn't fire you. Now, they don't have to rehire you, meaning re-sign your contract. So what are you talking about? What do you? There is no suit, Mr. DeMaurice. Your question, sir.
Yeah, my question is: have you ever missed out on an opportunity that made you change something in your life?
Ooh, yeah, man. Wow. I know I missed out. Probably, I missed out on some opportunities. I don't know if it changed. I don't know if it really changed, but the one that came on my, excuse me, real quick. I remember years ago, I took, I was in radio, and I was part-time at the time, and I just started, I said, you know what, let me just send some demo tapes out, see what the hell is going on here. And I sent some out, and I sent one to a station in Atlanta. It was V103, if I think at the time, if I'm not mistaken. And I said, you know what? You know, I'm young. I'm going to take a ride down to Atlanta, see the city, and just show up to the station. And one day, I did that. I took a train down to Atlanta. And the next day, you know, put on my business attire, had my copy of my demo tape. I said, I'm going to see if I can, you know, speak with the program director. So I'm walking through the, they were like on the 8th floor of this building. I go in and speak to a couple of people, and I'm getting on an elevator. And this gentleman and I, we speak. Yeah. He said, what are you doing here? I said, well, you know, I sent a demo tape to the program director of V103. And I said, you know, I'm going to come down and just see if I can talk to him. He said, okay, where are you from? I said, yeah, I'm back from Connecticut. He said, what are you doing? And I gave him that. So we're talking a little bit. When we get to the floor and the door open. The door opens, you open up right to the actually where the station is. As the door opened, he said to me, hey, he said, I'm so-and-so, the program director. He said, have a seat. I'll be off to see you in 10 minutes. I'm like, oh, shoot. Here we go. This is it. I'm like, this couldn't happen any better. Hey, I'm talking to the man, basically explain. So we come in. He hadn't listened to my tape previously. He got it in the mail. He said he got it, but he didn't listen to it. He dropped my tape in, and he listens, and he goes, okay. He said, you know what? He said, I could put you on part-time, but he said, you might have to, you've got to find some other things to do to us. And he said, yeah. He said, you know, I could definitely put you part-time and do some work. We could work together, and, you know, who knows where it goes from there. And I was like, okay. I was like, all right. Gave it some thought, you know, and I was like, and called him back. You know, I thank you for the offer, but I don't think I'm gonna you know, take advantage of it. Appreciate it, and left it there. And what I probably should have really have done, realistically, I always look back and thought what I should have done is basically took the position, found a way to fortify other parts of my income, moved to Atlanta. Who almost knows where to win? I mean, I had no idea where that could have went, but I chose not to, and I walked away from that. And looking back at it, to me, the right thing would have been done to do is to, hey, that was a gift. I mean, that thing worked. The way that worked out, there's no way in the world I should have walked away from that. But in my time, in my way of thinking, I was thinking, okay, I want to be full-time. I want to be in the air. I want to be kicking ass on the air. And it's like, with that being said, part-time, I was like, nah, and I walked away from it. But I'm not saying that it may broaden my thinking, but to what how it changed me, other than that, that's what it did. Mr. Charles, your response.
Wow. That's deep. I'm trying to think. Yeah, I think there was one opportunity I thought I had. I've always wanted to work for a newspaper, a daily newspaper. I tried to work at home, didn't work out. I talked to some friends at USA Today, all kind of places and whatever. But I went to, I think it was Fort Wayne, Indiana. And the gentleman told me that they had a copy editor position, which means you just be editing copy all the time and then you'd be shooting it back to the people. But he told me that he cannot hire me because he felt as if I had the passion to be a writer so much that I would not last long. And I was like, I just didn't want a job and I want to learn. And he said, no, you won't be here long. And I said, okay. So I did well over there and came back. And then at that point, the change was I was so stuck on being a writer for a particular daily newspaper that I said to myself, why not take advantage of what I had? Because I was already a sports editor at a minority newspaper, a black newspaper, jump on this and use that, what I have on my hand, to do some great things. And that allowed me to take off and really do a lot of stuff as far as sports was concerned by proving my worth there. The other part of it, too, made me say, I'm never going to be in a position where I'm going to let somebody dictate to me how I work. That's the only position I have. What I mean by that is I just worked on expanding my skills. So it was not just newspaper writing, editing. I jumped into some video videography, editing. I've just continued to advance my skill set. So there's really not much I can do. So now literally I can sit in front of a type situation or department and I can tell people what to do as a director or a manager. So definitely that kind of boosted me to go, if I have all those skill sets, there's nothing you can stop me from doing.
Yeah, man. Those it's funny how those things, when they come to you, sometimes we just don't you don't kind of open ourselves up to it. And we do stand back later on and kind of witness or think about what it could have been. Your response to your question, sir?
Yeah, man, I'm going to keep it light. I was with this sketch comedy group years ago, and we had just finished performing, and it was a place that we performed, and across the street was a tavern that I pass by every now and then now, and I think about this story. But anyway, we would go to this tavern, and usually we meet with the folks that were in the audience and things of that sort. And it was this fine Middle Eastern woman. She was so fine. And she was like, oh, I love you on stage, such and such and such and such and such. And she was there with a friend, and she was like, yeah, this is my last date night in town because I have to go do an internship at a hospital in New York City. And she was like, I really want to spend some time with you, get to know you tonight. So I have to go to another party, but let's exchange numbers so I can text you later. And, you know, we can, you know, hook up, you know, later on the night. So I'm like, okay. So as we're sitting there, you know, I was drinking. And, she had left. And meanwhile, it was this blonde lady, this big blonde lady, just kept trying to maul me the whole night. So I got to the phone. I felt the text, a vibration of the text message. And I got to the phone, and I didn't read the text message clearly. I thought she was like, you know, well, I don't know how I read it, but I felt like things weren't a go at that particular time. And I got home later that night and woke up the next morning and went through my text messages, and she had been wanting to meet up, and I read the text message wrong. This is when I knew I needed glasses. So at this point in my life, I got reading glasses in every room in my – I'm like Red Fox, stand for the sun. I don't have a drawer full of glasses, but I got reading glasses and glasses everywhere. I'm like, I missed out. And so when I tried to text her back the next day, saying, yo, I'm sorry, such and such, she didn't respond until maybe a month later and say, you know, I thought, you know, you probably went with somebody else, such and such and such. And she became a doctor and you know, very influential out in the East Coast. And from time to time, we chit-chat. But I'm like, bruh. You missed the opportunity. Get you some, because I've been fighting it all this time. I'm getting glasses, you know. I don't need glasses. And I can see, but I'm like, bro, get yourself some glasses. And when you get a text message, put your glasses on and read the text message fully, so you won't miss another opportunity.
Man, we got a minute. We got a minute left, Mr. Charles. I think it was bamboozled with that question, man. He talked about like a business opportunity, like. Now, he swung it all the way around. You just said about a woman, bro. You got me to more than time. With your question, my bro. You took that to a whole different level.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. That's my job. Yes, you did.
Y'all have a good week. We're going to go.